In this episode, we're taking a nice brisk walk through the wildflowers as Dean and I discuss Tom Petty's seminal 1994 release. Stay with us.
Get ready for the 3324 podcast, where lifelong friends Dean Legiro and Eric Cooper share their love of all things music and movies. Dean has directed short films and is a music trivia buff. And Eric, trained in audio engineering, brings his extensive knowledge of music and film to the conversation as they discuss, debate, and celebrate their favorite albums, films, and much more.
Welcome back, our friends, to the show that never ends. This is the 3324 podcast. My name is Eric Cooper. I am here with Dean Legiro. And yes, I am in the center seat tonight. Dean made me do this. Didn't you, Dean?
I don't know. This seat feels kind of strange. I was wondering what was going on. Is this how it feels? This seat has like no cushioning in it.
Right. The crappy seat. You get the cushy one most of the time, and I'm kind of like sitting on the wooden chair.
Some upgrades are in order. I'm gonna get you a new chair. Sorry, I didn't know.
Hey, if you're joining us, then we know that you know exactly where to find us. But for those who don't know where to find us, you can check us out on 3324.buzzsprout.com, the ultimate hub for podcasting. You could catch us on Spotify, iTunes, Stitcher, all the major podcasts. We're available there. We're also available on social media, Facebook, Instagram, and YouTube, where we do have extra trivia. We have bi-weekly live shows. So catch us there. We appreciate your support, your listening in. And Dean, we're doing the first episode of November. And guess what? This is our first full-on music episode in quite a while, isn't it?
Yeah, we've done a whole month of Halloween stuff. Spooktober. So I'm ready to listen to music.
Spooktober
is over.
It is over. Right. Well, we had a blast with this month. I think it went well. I think we had special thanks to everyone who participated in our live shows. Congratulations to all our winners in our Monster Mash. A special thanks goes out to Andrew Kremenes for helping us out with a couple episodes of The Crow and our top three horror icons episodes. So I can't think of a better way to start off the month of November than to talk about this album, Tom Petty's Wildflowers. It was. Let's get to some stats here about the album straight out the gate here. It was released on November 1st in 1994, produced by Rick Rubin, co-produced by Tom Petty and Mike Campbell. And it was recorded in the famous Sound City. The sessions began in July of 1992 and ended in July of 94. Took 2 years to make this album. That is incredible. I mean, that is just absolutely, there's no way that you can do that today. There's no way that anybody could have that kind of studio time today. It's absolutely insane. It spawned four singles. You Don't Know How It Feels, You Wreck Me, Good to Be King, and A Higher Place. And it was certified three times platinum, sold 3 million copies. Not a slouch nice. Whatsoever.
Nice.
Of course, it was outdone by your favorite, which is Full Moon Fever, five times platinum there. But of course, the real monster, his best-selling album of all is his greatest hits album.
It's got everything on it. I mean, for crying out loud.
A whopping 12 million copies
It better be his biggest selling album. It's got all of his hits.
Yeah, we're heading into Eagles territory right there.
Yes,
right?
I was just going to, that's what I was thinking of when you said that. I'm like the Eagles greatest hits is like one of the top selling albums of all time. And it better be, right?
Yeah. Right.
I mean, Thriller is the number one, but that's basically like a greatest hits album.
No, actually, Eagles outdid Thriller. I just read it. I actually just read an article about that. So Eagles is back on top. The best-selling album of
greatest
of all
hits
time.
Volume 1.
Volume 1. Yep. Anyway, let's before we get into the album Wildflowers, let's scale it back a bit. Let's talk a little bit about our personal history in Tom Petty. I'm kind of intrigued by this portion of the conversation because I don't really know where you stand with Tom Petty, honestly. We talk about him all the time.
Yeah.
And yet there are times where you're like really excited about the guy. And then there are times where you're just kind of like, yeah, he was good. He was okay. But so what was the moment for you? Like, when was the first time that you really, that you actually got into Tom Petty?
I think much like the Eagles, he's one of those artists that has those, that has that catalog of all those songs that you know, and maybe it's one or two per album. The first Tom Petty album I bought, oddly enough, is probably his worst or his least popular. It's Let Me Up, I've Had Enough.
Okay.
Because they used to play the video for Jammin' Me on MTV all the time. And I liked it. It's just like a catchy, it's kind of a chunky guitar song written by Bob Dylan. So I'm like, let me get that. So I picked up the cassette, and as it was back then, I only listened to that one song.
Mm-hmm.
You know?
Yeah, so the rest of the album didn't do it for you?
I don't even think I bothered. I just bought it to listen to Jammin' Me and just listen to that over and over. I think when Tom Petty really came to the forefront, though, was probably Traveling Wilburys.
Yeah.
You know, really kind of brought him.
Absolutely. Yeah.
You know, into the spotlight as an artist, and not like the Heartbreakers and this kind of, you know, he was doing great for himself, but I think the Wilburys just kind of uplifted him as an artist, and then right into Full Moon Fever trajectory.
Yeah, let's touch upon that a little bit. Speaking for myself, I was never really a big avid classic Heartbreakers fan. I mean, of course the songs were all over the radio. They were very much part of the soundtrack of our lives. We keep referring to that, but it was more, I think it was MTV really that got me into Tom Petty. It was the videos that he was making.
Yeah.
You Got Lucky.
That's one of my favorite songs by him of all time. Yeah,
absolutely. But again, the album, not great. It's just the song, and then more than that, it's the music video with that extra piece of music in the beginning, and it has a story. And I think
it's Mad Max-ish.
Yeah, bar none. I think those are some of the finest music videos ever made from the classic MTV era. And of course, the song he did with Dave Stewart for the Southern Accents.
Don't come around here no more.
Don't come around here no more, which was so odd at the time, and it was just. But that got me kind of thinking. Because Dave Stewart always kind of reminded me of Jeff Lynne.
Sure.
Right? So he's doing this guy. He's doing something with this guy. It's all like sort of like this drum machines, and is totally unlike anything Petty had ever done before.
The signs were there.
I think
the signs were there that he was thinking maybe about. Or maybe it wasn't. Maybe, you know, I mean, the Heartbreakers have always been like this band, right? They're like, like One for All and All for One and like the Blood Three Brothers. Musketeers. Even though it's Tom Petty and the Heartbreakers, it's kind of like they've always been kind of like a unit.
Mm-hmm.
And yeah, and then he, you know, once he does like Traveling Wilburys and then goes solo, I'll be honest, the Heartbreakers got kind of whiny, except for Mike Campbell. He took it like a man.
Yeah. Yeah, we'll get to that in a bit. So we'll discuss that at length. But because that's one of my favorite stories, and I know that's
the exactly Heartbreakers crying. The Heartbreakers got their heart broken by Tom Petty. Oddly enough, Tom Petty was the one that did it.
Actually, I think they got their heart broken by Jeff Lynne. Yeah. Jeff Lynne was the guy. He was.
They'll get over it.
The outsider, as it were, according to them. But anyway. But yeah, I agree. The Wilburys, that whole thing was just amazing. That was just an amazing. And oddly enough, I really was really into all the collaborative things that he had done prior to the Wilburys. You think about what he was doing with Stevie Nicks, with the Heartbreakers being more or less the house band for her Belladonna album, and then of course the song, you know, Stop Dragging My Heart Around, and the other song on her second solo LP too, which was another duet that they did, and then of course the stuff with Dave Stewart. So yeah, it was that stuff and the MTV period that really kind of got me into Petty, more or less more into him as an interesting figure rather than Tom Petty and the Heartbreakers, which again was just sort of just Americana, straightforward, but. To me, sort of unremarkable up to that point, because I didn't have any of their albums specifically. You think of Dan the Torpedoes and Hard Promises. I didn't have any of those albums. Mm-hmm. I just didn't really even know what songs came from what album.
Yeah.
You know, so it was kind of like, because they were all so close together at that point. You know, so the years go by and you just hear Tom Petty and the Heartbreakers on the radio. Yeah.
I think he's one of those artists that you took for granted.
Exactly.
Like, kind of like Billy Squire and the Cars and
Billy
artists
Joel.
Of that era that had all these hits.
That's right.
And they would come out with such regularity that, the lines get a little blurred. You're not sure. what album this was or what, you know, what it's just like, oh yeah, there's another great, is another great song, you know,
yeah,
You Got Lucky and The Waiting and, you know, Change of Heart, like so many things just kind of roll out. We're rolling out of them.
Mm-hmm.
That, yeah, it's just like, oh, yeah, Tom Petty and the Heartbreakers. Okay. They're great.
That's
like,
right.
And, but then when I think when Southern Accents came out is like, you're right. And like we talked about before, the MTV effect, right? With the, mm-hmm. Don't Come Around Here No More video was just so groundbreaking and striking, the whole Alice in Wonderland thing and
yeah,
and the trippiness of it, kind of all of a sudden that got into heavy rotation and that just kind of pushed the Heartbreakers like really in front and center as not only a music group, but as a visual yeah, group too, that made really good videos or interesting videos.
There was a level of creativity there that was happening. And that's what I admired about Petty. He wasn't afraid to go there. He loved the camera. There's no doubt about it. I mean, you just, yeah, he had such presence. I recall seeing Stevie Nicks in concert. I had never seen Tom Petty and the Heartbreakers. They were one of those groups that just got away from me. But I recall seeing Stevie Nicks at Radio City, and he came out to do just a few songs with her. And God, what a badass. I mean, he just, you know, the stage presence. And this was really early on. We're talking like 83.
Mm.
And this is before all of this other stuff, you know, came out. So I, you know, so that was the moment for me. I was like, yeah, this guy's pretty cool, you know? So, and then
he wasn't like an A-list. He wasn't an A-lister then.
No.
You know, like Tom,
no,
like
by no
when
means.
Stop Dragging My Heart came around, they were kind of like maybe a C or a B or a C-lister. I mean, they were a regular act and very
yep,
successful, but they were not where they would be by 92.
Yeah, but they got to they did get to the level of, you know, somebody took notice and asked them, you know, Bob Dylan, you know, yeah, they needed an opening act, I think it was at the time. And somebody requested that it be Tom Petty and the Heartbreakers. And it's like, well, they don't open for anybody. They're big enough where they're probably not going to want to open for Bob. Why not back Bob Dylan?
Yeah.
Sort of like a la the Band back in the day. And that was a major, major success, that tour. It was a huge, you know, and yeah, I think coming off that tour, right, this is where it all started, right, with the...
Well, it actually started during that tour.
Yeah,
with the I think when they were playing yeah,
In England.
Dylan was playing in England somewhere, yep, and at the time, Jeff Lynne and George Harrison were kind of creating their relationship and becoming good friends. So they went to go see Dylan.
Yeah.
You know, at concert, and of course, Petty was there, and then they went backstage, and they all kind of exchange pleasantries, and that was kind of the end of it. I mean, they just kind of met and like, okay, yeah, this is really cool.
Yeah, they kind of, well, and we got to give credit where credit's due. I mean, I think it was the album that started the whole shebang was a little album called Cloud Nine, which Jeff Lynne had produced for George Harrison. And I think
I might go further back. Hang on, because there's a root. I don't know. I've only read the story once.
Okay,
but, you know, because there's all these different stories about how that happened, but I would go back to Dave Edmunds' album Information that Jeff Lynne produced, and he wrote a lot of the songs on it. From what I've read,
mm-hmm,
George Harrison was looking to have Dave Edmunds produce his album.
Oh,
and he said, "I'm not available or something. Why don't you reach out to Jeff Lynne?"
Interesting.
Yeah,
did not know that.
So I think his work with Dave Edmunds might have kind of laid the ground, the really like the early, you want to talk about like digging the foundation. I think this was like the shovel work that they did when Jeff Lynne worked with Dave Edmunds.
So this I didn't realize that was a full on album that Jeff Lynne had produced. So Dave Edmunds was the first artist that he had produced full on album.
And then he did most of his second album and wrote a lot of the stuff for his second Riff Raff or whatever it was called. So,
you know,
but Cloud Nine is like the, you want to start the timeline.
Yeah.
If you're going to collect, we absolutely could do it. And we could do an 87 to 93 episode of just all of those people in the orbit. Cause there's so many albums that came out rapid fire.
That's right.
Like literally one, like if it wasn't George Harrison, it was Tom Petty. It was Roy Orbison. It was the Wilburys. And then it was Jeff Lynne. And then it was another Wilbur, you know, like
that's right.
There was so much going on. Almost like they were like four people doing the work of Phil Collins. like what Phil Collins did from like 81 to like 88
yeah,
or something, like
yeah,
it took four people to do from like 87 to like 92 or 93.
Absolutely. Yeah. Yeah. And boy, we were there for all of it, weren't we? It was an exciting time.
I saw Petty during the Full Moon Fever tour.
You did.
In New York. And I was like hoping, I'm like, oh, I think I was actually hope for some odd reason. I think it was pie in the sky to expect that Jeff Lynne would come out, but I think I was hope. I don't know if Ringo Starr was in New York at the time or something. Like, oh, maybe he'll come because he was in the video.
Yeah,
For Won't Back Down, and I got to see him there, and that was just like that was like seeing The Who. It was just like a greatest hits. It was just like boom, 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 yeah. Like one song after the other, just kind of rolling it off, and then the stuff from Full Moon Fever. So it was a great show.
Petty got a copy of Cloud Nine. Right. He listened to the album, loved it, loved the way it sounded, loved the production on it. The story goes, right? They're both Jeff Lynne and Tom Petty living in L.A. at this point. I think it was Jeff Lynne driving down, Sunset Boulevard or so, and he sees Tom Petty, like they stop for a red light. Tom Petty pulls up right alongside him and said, hey, you know, what's going on? So they pull over. So they're basically talking about Cloud Nine and you did such a great job. Would you be interested in doing something for me? And of course, Jeff Lynne just jumped on it. And he's just, yeah. So yep. it sort of started there. I mean, simultaneously, we had that going on and the Wilburys starting at the same time. But Wilburys came out first because they kind of just banged that out, didn't they? I mean,
I think this put Tom Petty on the path to understanding that there's Tom Petty and the Heartbreakers and then there's Tom Petty.
Yeah.
You know, and that he got it. He kind of said, he kind of figured, well, I can do some stuff that's just me.
Yeah.
And it can be different. And it doesn't have to, you know, because they worked with Jimmy Iovine like year after year in production and he records a certain way. They record live. They just lay everything down, like play it, and that's pretty much it. And I think this is where the awakening that leads to Wildflowers. I think that's where this stuff happening is interacting with the Wilburys and being in a different group of people, different ways of working. And I think that kind of all this stuff through here kind of, I think, laid the groundwork for Wildflowers where we're going to land at. And to tie up the Jeff Lynne stuff, I don't think, just to put it out there, I don't think Jeff Lynne could have done Wildflowers.
No.
Like there's no way that the stuff on Wildflowers, I hear where Tom Petty learned stuff from Full Moon Fever. But Wildflowers, I think, is him taking everything that he's learned from those past few years and then bringing it and internalizing it and saying, well, now here's what it's going to be like as me.
Absolutely.
You know, I think that's where Wildflowers is kind of, and I don't know if that's why people like it so much, because it's the anti Full Moon Fever in a way.
Yeah.
Because I
can see it.
You know, it's got a certain sound to it, which again, like I said, Jeff Lynne would not have been able to achieve because he's an architect and Rick Rubin is more of a recorder and he kind of understands the artist and he kind of like lets them do what they need to do, but helps to guide them. And you don't feel, there's not really like a Rick Rubin imprint. Like he doesn't have a particular sound. He's got a particular style of working with different artists, because he's worked with, you know, Tom Petty, the Avett Brothers, the Cult. I knew him from the Beastie Boys when they used to make those goofy music videos. He was almost like a de facto member of the Beastie Boys making those goofy videos. Like Rick Rubin was in all those videos. He was like a young guy. And when they're blowing up things on the beach and just doing all the goofy stuff that the Beastie Boys did in the beginning, Rick Rubin was like right at the forefront. So that's where I kind of knew him from License to Ill. I was like,
it was an odd choice at first. And I think what happened was with, you know, Tom Petty's, left MCA Records at this point, wanted to jump over to Warner Brothers. And I think the head of Warner Brothers at the time introduced him to Rick Rubin. And so that's how that relationship started. But even then, I think Petty was thinking Rick Rubin, like, he, you know, but I think what happened was there was at Bob Dylan's 30th anniversary concert that they did. He had seen Rick Rubin standing in the wings, and Rick Rubin was listening to, oddly enough, he was listening to a lot of Neil Young, sort of acclimating himself to the music of Neil Young. And I perhaps he was like looking to work with him at some point or whatever. But that's when Tom Petty kind of knew, like, yeah, I could work with this guy, because you know, he gets that kind of music as well, despite the fact that he did all this other kind of stuff, which is Tom Petty's
before that, he was known for thrash, he was known for Slayer. I mean, he worked with a diverse group of artists, and then he would go on to work with Johnny Cash with the American recording stuff. So more so now, I think he kind of skews towards that way. But yeah, he was a nice foil. And again, like I said, he's kind of like the anti-Jeff Lynne, which is, I think, is what Petty needed, is just a space to work in and people to work with to help, not to shape the sound, but to help guide the sound, as it were.
That's right. Full Moon Fever was a monster album. And I mean, that I remember specifically the moment that you first heard the album, and see if you agree. Right?
Oh boy.
Do you remember? I mean, no. Okay.
If it's embarrassing, don't say it.
No, it's not embarrassing at all. It's actually pretty cool because okay. I actually had the album first. I had it on cassette. I had just bought it, listened to it a couple of times, and you had that sky blue Camaro.
Mm-hmm.
Remember?
And it was
a beautiful car. But it was a
biggest piece of junk.
It was cool
to have a Camaro.
It was a freaking tin can is what it was, because it was so uncomfortable to sit in that damn thing. And you had those white bucket seats, and it was just kind of like, oh, you know, like this. And I distinctly remember having the cassette, and we were going to dinner with our friend John. And I don't know what the occasion was. I think it was just probably celebrating a night of Nathan's or some arcade, you know, frivolity or whatever.
Defender,
you know?
And Gauntlet. Pac-Man and Ms. Pac-Man.
So we put the cassette in and we're kind of blasting this thing. And I distinctly remember, like, running down a dream, you kept hitting the rewind button on that song. And I think we must have listened to that song like three times in a row.
Really? Man, yeah. I don't remember that.
You don't? Okay.
No.
That was the moment that I thought that you and I would have like been like, yeah, we like Tom Petty now, you know? So that was, for me, Full Moon Fever was, I was a Tom Petty.
Oh yeah,
Petty
no, absolutely. Full, that became
point.
Full on. Yeah. He was kind of there and it absolutely became full on.
So he invited, this is his first solo record. He invited several members of the Heartbreakers to play on it. And this is where this story gets a little interesting. They come in. They're not used to, you know, first of all, they don't really like this. We're talking Howie Epstein, Stan Lynch, and Ben Montench. Now, the three of them, they were kind of like talking smack about the album, like, you know, out there. We don't like this. We don't like the music. We don't care for it. Mike Campbell is like Tom Petty's right hand man. He'll do
whatever.
Anything.
Yeah, right, he'll do whatever.
So. Yeah, so
he'll show up to the opening of an envelope.
Needless to say, it's like you mentioned before, the very regimented style of Jeff Lynne's production was not something that they were used to at all. They came in and they're just not used to some guy telling them, you got to come in and play just this little bit of music and then leave the room. You know, they were used to the sort of hanging out and, the, you know, just sort of, you know.
And playing live and recording
and
live.
Playing live and doing
playing
what they
live
do.
And recording it. Yeah, laying it down live, which was what their work ethic was with Jimmy Iovine.
Right. The odd thing for me is, okay, so there was already that tension that was there. So then the odd thing was Tom Petty decided the next album to do, which was Into the Great Wide Open. I guess maybe he thought maybe by calling it a Heartbreakers record, having the full-on band come back and then being... We're
involved.
This is Tom Petty and the Heartbreakers. He does the same thing. He picks Jeff Lynne to produce it. And once again, Jeff Lynne, very hands-on, right? He's not just a producer. He plays, he sings, he co-writes. You know, he's really involved in this stuff. And it's like, this really put Stan Lynch over the edge, because at that point, he just had it. He's like,
He was already boiling over.
Yeah. So... Which is a shame, but, you know, creative differences. And, you know, like Tom Petty said, it's like, you know, nobody really cares how an album's made. You just try to make the best album you can.
Yeah.
And you use whatever tools.
They were a little butthurt by it. Oh, you know,
exactly.
We don't do it this way, or I'm not going to play this or that. It's like, all right, well, I mean, Tom, you know, just to wrap it up, I guess Tom Petty sided with Jeff Lynne both times. It's not like he said, oh, Jeff Lynne, get out of here.
That's right.
His allegiance was to doing something different. It could have been anybody, not to go on, you know, to make this all about Jeff Lynne. It could have been any producer. His thing was, I need to try something different. I want to do some different things. And that's exactly why it's not a Heartbreakers record, because we're not going to do it like a Heartbreakers record. And that, like I said, that set his kind of feet on the path of understanding. And if you look at the discography, it was Full Moon Fever. Mm-hmm. Into the Great Wide Open, and then another solo album, not counting the greatest hits, right?
Yeah.
So it was literally two solo albums sandwiched in between one album with the guy that he worked on with his first solo album. You know,
so
that kind of gives you some indications that he was really kind of chomping at the bit and it's like he wanted them on board. Like, yeah, you guys are invited to come on board, but they were just kind of like, oh, we don't, you know, I think they warmed up to it a little bit. I read some recent interview with Ben Montench. Like, yeah, no, I kind of get what Jeff Lynne was doing. It's just at the time he actually thanked Jeff. I just read an interview. He thanked Jeff Lynne because Ben Montench was so like alcoholic and into drugs. He's like, because I had nothing to do, mm-hmm. I had no choice but to go to rehab. We're oddly enough. So he's like, I kind of thanked Jeff Lynne for that.
For dismissing me and then
for not using, yeah, not using me. So, me to- yeah, so I think that brings us to Wildflowers, where it's kind of like here he is.
Yeah.
He's kind of now carved out his own identity.
Exactly.
And right? he's now also Tom Petty. He's not just Tom Petty of Tom Petty and the Heartbreakers. He's now kind of like what Bruce Springsteen did with the E Street Band. He broke from them and started making Bruce Springsteen albums and then would have also the E Street Band albums.
Very much in total creative control here. Rick Rubin kind of came in and he was, you know, you're right. He invited the Heartbreakers to come in to play on the record, and he kind of wanted to have that sort of live band feel again. But they ended, you know, Tom Petty knew better at this point. He knew not to do it like the Heartbreakers do it. Like they cut some of these tracks really early on, and they're very much, I haven't actually got to listen to it yet, but I do have the Finding Wildflowers, the alternate versions mm-hmm. of some of the songs. I've read the liner notes on the album, and a lot of those tracks actually have, it's just Tom Petty and the Heartbreakers. So I would imagine, and they do say that they are very much in sort of going back to the old style of the way mm-hmm. they used to do things. And at this point, Tom Petty's like, we've been there. We didn't down this road before. I want to try something different here. Mm-hmm. So he had total control, creative yep. reign in that studio, using the studio, not relying on somebody like Jeff Lynne at this point. He's the man now. He knows exactly where he wants to be, ready to try different things. And
yeah,
and
I think when you call it a solo album too, it's less democratic, right? Because if it's a Heartbreakers album, and then the Heartbreakers, they weren't just like paid employees. It was a group. I mean, they were a group, even though they were and the Heartbreakers. Mm-hmm. And so they have a say. I mean, they had a say in those things. And I think when you say, well, I'm going to make a solo album and you guys can play on it, or I want you to play on it, he's kind of getting the best of both worlds, right? He's getting his band, but then he's also able to say, well, we're not going to do it just this way, or we may do some songs this way. That's right. Some other songs are going to be a little bit different. And you can hear that in the album. Some songs are kind of sound like turn the mics on, put the faders up and go. And then some songs are really have some really nice production values to them, and some mm-hmm. strings and some of those lush things that you wouldn't expect to hear based on the contrasting other songs that you hear, like Honeybee. And like, there's some really hard edge stuff on this album. And then it's contrasted with some really delicate and introspective stuff too. So that's kind of really, what grabbed you about, because this was your choice, this album. You're like, I really want to do Wildflowers. Why?
Because
you always mention this album when you never really mentioned Full Moon Fever,
my younger self, The
Highway Companion.
If I were to say like, if you were to ask me, what's your favorite album? And if you were to ask like me 25 years ago, I would have most definitely said either Full Moon Fever. I also liked Into the Great Wide Open. Mm-hmm. I love that album as well, because to me it was more or less an extension of the same kind of thing. But you know, this is the kind of album you kind of grow into, and mm-hmm. it, you know, unfortunately, you go through some experiences that makes you appreciate the album for what it is, and because this is his most personal. Mm-hmm. He's definitely wearing his emotions on his sleeve, much to the amazement and the surprise of his, you know, his close bandmates, you know, because he had never really written songs to this degree before. I mean, he mm-hmm. was going through some stuff at this point. He, you know, his marriage was falling apart. Stan Lynch leaving the band had some, you know, that had something to do with it as well.
Mr. Cranky right. Pants.
Yeah, that had, you know, so they had
but
to
they
get
in. But they got Steve Ferroni.
Steve Ferroni, right, who
you
came
know,
on.
I think, you know, I like Stan Lynch's drumming. It's kind of like a little, it's much looser and a little more kind of untamed. But Steve Ferroni, I think, is definitely a trade up.
Oh, absolutely.
Because he, on this album, he kind of, he's got that kind of drumming that's kind of forceful, but it's grounded and it's very solid. And You Wreck Me and stuff like that, you need someone like that. He's like a pocket drummer, and he really, I think he really helps kind of tie this album together and give it, you know, for those up-tempo songs, I think he absolutely helps give it a tighter feel.
Yeah, I agree.
Not so loosey-goosey.
To say that I got into this album in 94, you know, that's not true. It actually took me a couple of years. I mean, I had to go through those experiences to kind of relate to it. Mm-hmm. But when I did, when I actually listened to the album full on, it was an experience that, to me, and it's not an album that I can, it's not my first choice. Full Moon Fever would be my first choice. Mm-hmm. If I were, I'm going to listen to Tom Petty today, it's going to be that or The Greatest Hits or whatever. Mm-hmm. This album is just one of those albums for me that I put it away on the shelf and I cherish, because it's just, for me, his finest hour. Mm-hmm. In terms of just the level of songwriting and just how many songs that he was writing at his most prolific period, I think. I mean, he'd be finishing one track one day and you know, doing multiple takes on one track, get that done, and then he's already had another song written. And okay, well, here's another one for you. And, you know, the album was supposed to be a double album upon release. It was supposed to be 25 tracks long. Of course, at this point, there was really no such thing as vinyl anymore. So it would have been a long form CD. And of course the record company was like, it's way too long. You got to turn it down.
Nah.
But 15 songs is still a long CD.
Absolutely. Right?
I mean, back in the day, a 15 song album, that would have been a double album in the 70s.
Yeah, easily.
You know? Yeah. So for me, it's what's remarkable about this record more than anything is how warm it feels and inviting it feels. Mm-hmm. You are in the room with these group of people and you're there for the duration. I just love the mood it sends and the place that I'm in when I listen to it. It does require your full attention, you know, because there are a lot of songs that are acoustic, they're stripped down, they're, you know, it's not the full on Heartbreaker sound. Like you said before, there are some rockers to it.
I don't listen to this album and say this sounds like, you know, Long After Dark or any of those things. Like even the hard stuff is different. It's harder than the Heartbreaker stuff that he does as well. Mm-hmm. You know, so it's got a different feel to it. It doesn't have like the Ben Montench like keyboards in the back where he's just kind of holding the notes and kind of, you know, like that organy stuff. So this, even though he's on the album, and the Heartbreakers are there, they're used in a different way, and it's got such a different feel to it.
Yeah, there's a lot of like really nice layering, and there's horns on this album. There's strings. Michael Kamen, the composer.
Good, at the end of Good to Be King, right? It's got that whole string outro.
Right, that's right. And, you know, this allowed for other people to come in. Some notable cameos on this album were Carl Wilson sings on a couple of tracks, and Ringo Starr, you know, came in for some, and these were earlier sessions, but they, but he was there nonetheless. And so, you know, so people kind of came and went, and it took, like I said, 2 years to make the damn thing. So, you know,
plenty of time for guests.
It's not gonna sound exactly the same when you first started to when, you know, right up till the end. So,
yeah, and especially if you rework the songs. I mean, you know, there's that massive, what is it, like a four, is it like a four LP set? Or, you know, they did like the double album, and then
They
released something called, what was it called, Angel Dream? Which was
several,
some of the remnants from that went to the next Heartbreakers album, which was the soundtrack to She's the One.
The 10
which
was songs the that were release. Omitted from the initial release. Were four of those tracks did appear on that. And
on She's the One.
On She's the One. And what they did was take some of those songs and actually write little instrumental passages of the melodies of those songs. And so it was almost like a score as well for that as well. And they reconfigured that into an actual album because they kind of, shed the movie side of it, I guess, because maybe the movie's just that forgettable or something.
I love She's the One. It's fun. It's Edward Burns. Yeah. I love it. It's a cult classic.
I'd never seen it actually,
I like it. I like the stuff that Edward Burns was doing around then, like Brothers McMullen and stuff like that. She's the One is the same thing. It's the brothers that are bickering. The Irish brothers that are bickering, the father, the older father that lives with them and is always yelling at them. Like it's just a, you know, it's a good album. I mean, mm-hmm. It's a good movie And the soundtrack, you know, it's got Lindsey Buckingham on it too, helping out Tom Petty.
It does.
On a few songs. So.
It does indeed.
Can't go wrong there. We're hitting all the favorites. We're hitting Jeff Lynne. We're hitting Lindsey Buckingham. I mean, you know, what do you want from me in this episode?
So, yeah, for me, it's like being invited. You know, you listen to something like Full Moon Fever, and it's very much what it's, you know, what it conveys. It's the type of album you put on your full blast in your car. You know, a summer afternoon, you roll down the windows, you know, it's much like Jerry Maguire, you know, and Tom Cruise blasting, you know, Free Fall and singing at the top of your lungs. That's the kind of feel. Here, it's like being invited to his house, opening the door, walking down the hallway, entering the room. They're already playing the title track, you know, Wildflowers. And it really sets the mood for the entire album. And you just sit down and you just absorb this whole thing. And it really affected me in a more serious, emotional way. And yeah, I just think it's the finest thing he's ever done. I mean, despite, you know, all the great things he did with Jeff Lynne and stuff. It's real close, but this album kind of edges that out. And I think for a lot of people, it kind of has taken on that resonance. I mean, they may not have liked it that much at first, or perhaps they did.
Well, yeah, I think it was more of an understated album at the time.
Yeah.
In light of how popular Into the Great Wide Open was, because that, you know, that music video with Johnny Depp was everywhere. And and then, you know, with the Wilburys, it might have been a little bit of Petty overexposure, and doing Wildflowers kind of brought it back down a little bit, and kind of very understated, even though you don't know how it feels, was a pretty big music video at the time. But everything else on this album is even the heavier stuff, though, it's just like understated. It's just kind of like they just kind of recorded it and put it out. You know, it's kind of like, okay, here it is, you know, Wildflowers. And with a title like that, you think it's going to be something like that, like mellow and
yeah,
which a lot of it is, but I can't get away from the heavy stuff. You know, the heavy stuff is just heavy.
It is.
And I like, you know, like, oh my God.
When they played SNL and when, you know, cause Stan Lynch had left at this point and they didn't have Steve Ferrone yet. He was still on tour with someone at the time. They got Dave Grohl to play on drums on the SNL when they appeared on, you know, they did the couple songs there, and he was just like, me, what do you want me for? But when you see them play the song, you know, they really go all out. And of course, Dave Grohl is like
thrashing all over the place
in the background. Yeah. So, but then, you know, they did Letterman, and that's when Steve Ferrone was officially inducted into the band as a Heartbreaker. And I think as a result, this album really fended some menses.
Fended some menses. Now you're talking like me.
Mended some. Oh my God!
I did that the last episode.
That was horrible.
I did Niamh Leeson a couple of episodes ago. So,
oh my goodness.
Welcome to old age.
That's right. No, this
we're glad to have you.
Brought the Heartbreakers back to a level where they, you know, they had a new point of view.
Yeah, a reset.
They carried on. And I think I have to say a lot of the albums that came after this are, in my opinion, are some of the finest work he's ever done. Like some of these, like Echo, and you know, I'm thinking of Mojo and Hypnotic, even Hypnotic Eye was amazing. I mean, for so late in his career, you know?
Yeah. I think it was, I don't think it was the intent. I think Tom Petty with Wildflowers and his solo stuff kind of felt like he needed to do it, but it was exactly what the Heartbreakers needed. And they didn't realize it. Like they figured, oh, we're just going to keep going. We're a band. We make records together. I think it might have petered out if this other stuff didn't happen to him and he didn't have this kind of a surge of independence.
Yeah.
And saying, yeah, you know, I'm going to assert some control over stuff I want to do. But we still have the Heartbreakers and we're still involved. And it's not, you know, we're not breaking up. It's just a break, not breaking up. And on this album, I think there is a little bit of invigoration. Like they kind of got through Into the Great Wide Open, which is an experience that they weren't too fond of. And then you move into Wildflowers, where they're all there and they're all playing and they're all probably in a more comfortable environment where it's more, yeah, we're just going to lay this down, we'll record it, we'll get it done.
Yeah.
And you get some really, you know, top shelf stuff, you know, like Honeybee and mellow stuff, like Time to Move On. Oh my God. That's just, you know, there's just there's a lot of great stuff in here. I wrote down like six tunes, like really quick that, you know, I'm like, wow, I could just kind of listen to these.
Yeah, I got Wildflowers. That's actually Kelly's favorite. My wife Kelly's favorite. Mm-hmm. You don't know, of course, you don't know how it feels. Steve Ferroni's drumming on that. That's what really got him the gig. Yeah. I mean, it's just no. But you know what? I could actually picture Jeff Lynne producing that one. And I could
there
just
are a couple of tracks on here where I'm like, well, that was the thing is when I was listening to it, I'm like, oh, this sounds like could have been, but what that means is just that Tom Petty was learning,
yeah,
and absorbing, and you can't understate the influence of Rick Rubin also of giving him the latitude. Jeff Lynne has a certain style and a certain way of working, and that's why you hire him. There are other producers that are kind of like, yeah, I'm going to kind of guide and I'll give you some feedback and we'll toss some ideas around and see what happens and go from there. And that's what this feels like. This kind of feels like, yeah, of all those songs, they knocked out all these songs. It's like, well, here's like the cream of the crop.
Yeah.
And there's such a good mix of it too. So it's not like, oh, this is just a really mellow album. It's really not. I mean, there's a lot of like it with You Wreck Me. Honeybee, I mean, Cabin Down Below. I love that song. God,
that's epic. That one,
yeah, and, like because it sounds nothing like it doesn't sound like anything that they've ever done.
That's right,
Cabin Down Below. And I'm like, listen, I'm like, love, wow.
Which you know? This one sounds a little bit more sort of from you know also the but To Find a Friend. I that one kind of latched on.
Yep. I have that written down too. I have that
some lyrics of that really kind of hit home with me. And House in the Woods, I love is what you know. So I would love to have heard the album in its original sequential order, though. And that's something, oddly enough, nobody knows what the original sequential order is at this point. Even with the re-release and everything, they can't find it. The notes have been discarded, or not even Rick Rubin knows like how the album. Ada Petty, you know, Tom Petty's daughter, who put this package together, said, she goes, yeah, we used to have like my dad would always have like this tape, like it was one of those acid tapes that he would play all the time. It pretty much, I think, was probably the original, you know, sequential order, and it had an extra track on the very end, and she remembers the extra track, but she doesn't remember what the order of the album was.
It's everything
like,
else,
you know, like yeah. So you know,
As long as Wake Up Time is at the end, it's the perfect. You know, we talk a lot about closing songs and what kind of songs close out.
I think a couple of people have tried to put it in there, and I guess in their own way, in their own terms. But that's kind of the one thing I don't like about the all the rest portion of the re-release is the songs do feel somewhat tacked on, you know, because you have this amazing album before it and then you have these other songs. So I would have preferred to have, you know, if they even attempted to just kind of put them in some other order, you know, at this point. So, but that,
yeah, I mean, without any indication, though, you're just guessing.
But so it's a much better experience on vinyl. It is because you have those sides that you can, just the first five tracks on side one is like, yeah, that, you know, one great song after another. And they just, you know, so it's a much better experience on vinyl. I highly recommend it to anyone who has never, you know, because vinyl.
I have a vinyl story for you. I don't know if you remember it, but a few years ago, a friend of mine invited me to go like pick vinyl from his house. He was moving to California and he was kind of up a little further up the line in New York. And he's like, you know, I got all these albums, come get whatever you want. And I remember I called you and I said, listen, I'm going to look at some albums. I said, is there anything you want me to look for? And you said one thing. You literally said one thing.
Wildflowers.
You said, yeah, if there's a copy of Wildflowers, I'm like, what? I'm like, what copy of what? And you're like, copy of Wildflowers. And it wasn't there, even back then you were like on vinyl. That was like the only, you could have asked for like anything.
Yeah.
And you literally said, if there's a copy of Wildflowers, grab it.
Yeah. Cause I kind of,
which I would have done, but I would have made you pay. You would have paid.
Well, I don't think that there was, you know, there might've been a very extremely limited, you know, release. Yeah.
Well, 94, they were still making vinyl.
If you could find this album, it's worth well over like you're paying like $1,000 easy. For it, for an original copy, which is, you know, no way, but yeah, because I kind of figured, I mean, you know, listening to it on CD, it is a long CD to get through, you know, you have to really, you know, you end up skipping over tracks. You know, you do end up doing that. You know, you can't just listen to this album willy nilly and just, you know, sort of half-assed. And you got to really experience it from beginning to end and really absorb it. And I think vinyl really does that well. And I'm so glad that we're back in that mode where, you know, we can actually, you know, it may not be the original pressing, and you know that this obviously has been remastered. So,
well, I think no matter how you listen to it, you know, I think it deserves. Yeah, I think you're right about that. I don't think if you do this piecemeal, you kind of lose. I think you lose the script a little bit.
Yeah,
you know, where it's kind of like, yeah, I'm listening to three songs and I'm going to go do something and come back, and it's kind of like it is 15 songs, but if you have like a drive, you get to be in your car for a while, or you got some windshield time or whatever, you like put this on and just let it kind of wash over you. I mean, that's really what it is. It's got an intimate feel, but I don't, when I say intimate, I don't mean like sparse with just like a guy with a guitar and that's
no, all it's
you
intimate
have. Like
in Don the McLean, sense that
it's got a warm, like you said, it kind of has like a warm feeling and an inviting.
You are feeling in the room. You are in, it's a very in the room feel. It's a very, it's not over polished, the production standards on this album. So you do get the sense that you're actually watching these people play in your living room. So that's, I always have that feeling too. Like when I listen to it, especially with headphones, it's an amazing, amazing thing to hear. Last week I bought tickets to see the documentary on the making of this album. Did not get to see it, however. Went to the theater. Really, really pissed me off. I was so uh-oh. Annoyed. Yeah, went to the theater with my wife. We were all excited, you know, because this is one of her favorite albums as well. Mm-hmm. Sitting there, and we figured, well, we're just going to be like, you know, the only two people. I don't see a lot of people coming out to this thing, honestly. Because it kind of came out of nowhere, right? I mean, we freaking hear about it, if anybody even heard about it. But 50, there must have been at least 50, 60 people there, which is not bad, not a bad turnout for this thing, you know, this one time only kind of thing. And I was so stoked, and the screen just went blank, and they started playing the preview of another movie. And then all of a sudden the screen went blank and the manager came in and he's like, we can't show it. And I'm like, what do you mean you can't show it? How do you not have a physical copy of this movie?
That's the new thing, it gets streamed.
Yeah,
it gets streamed in digitally.
So that's what it was. And he said that our theater was not the only theater who had every Regal Cinema theater had problems with thing on the East Coast. So nobody got to see it if you went, which was too bad. But it will be available
on
YouTube.
Did they show you Trolls 2 instead, the animated?
No, they actually gave us tickets. We'll show you the new Bond film. I said, already seen it.
Don't need it. Done. How about the Tom Petty that I paid for?
That's
how
right.
How about that?
Yeah. So the
wow,
money I got.
That
so
sucked.
The money
I'm
I got.
Sorry.
Yeah. So the money I got back from that, I actually bought. I went ahead and bought the album. You know,
that's
all the
it.
Rest and
right?
And
the
other one
Regal
too.
Cinemas. Sorry, Regal.
That's right. So you know, there you go.
Tom Petty got the money anyway.
I finally got Wildflowers on vinyl. I got the the alternate version on vinyl.
Nice.
And then So that was. That's my experience with this album. I really can't reiterate enough of just how special this one. I consider it, dare I say it, it's right in the wheelhouse of Tusk. It's right in the wheelhouse. I would even go as far as to say Pet Sounds in that sense because it's so personal. Not musically, you know, sonically, you know, but
sure.
But because it's so like emotional and so sort of and this is, you know, us, we're not into like lyrics where, you know, music comes first, the production standards come first, but this is an album that I really took notice of and it really means a big deal to me. So it is my favorite album. That being
from Tom Petty.
Yes.
No, I totally see I get the Tusk comparisons. I get where you're simpatico with it, where you kind of could elevate it on that level. I totally see that in the album. And like I said, it's an evolution, right? And this is, it's really, you just made a really salient point, is that this is the Tusk to Full Moon Fever's Rumors, right? Where he makes an album that's wildly successful and people are going nuts. Tom Petty this, Tom Petty that, and yada, yada, yada. And then he's like, okay, let's kind of move away from that. Nothing against any of that, right? Not disavowing it. Let me move away from that and continue to try something. Like, that was him trying something different, and this was him trying something different again.
Yeah.
You know, he didn't just retreat into the Heartbreakers. He kind of got the Heartbreakers around him, but then said, let's go in and let me do another solo album, which again is really kind of odd that, you know, a Heartbreakers album is bookended by two solo albums. But if it's going to be stuff like this, you're not going to go wrong. Like I said, and I can't Wake Up Time. Oh my God. It's such a perfect way to, I know I said it before, but that's one of my favorites. Like that feels like a composer. Like that feels like a song that was composed. Not it's not like one of the rockers and the ravers. It's got a lush feeling to it, and I think that's the most emotional song for me for some reason. Something about his vocal. It's kind of vulnerable.
Yeah.
You know, very kind of a lot of solo, not a lot of instrumentation in parts of it, and then there is, you know, and I like that kind of stuff where it's kind of produced. So for me, that's kind of a and there's some through lines. There's some reminders. I think some songs call back to Full Moon Fever, in style. Now, let me ask you this.
Mm-hmm.
What about Highway Companion? Highway Companion for anybody, Highway Companion is
the third.
He made three solo albums, and that one wouldn't come until 2006. Mm-hmm. So he really kind of after knocking two out pretty much almost sequentially for the most part, took a 12-year hiatus and then decided to do another solo album
with Jeff Lynne.
With Jeff Lynne.
Jeff Lynne comes back on board.
I think the results are very different. They're not. It's not Full Moon Fever Part 2.
What happens here is the effect that Wildflowers had. Has on this album.
It's the combination of the two.
It's a warmer album. It's not the typical Jeff Lynne. It's scaled back.
But it's got that tightness. Know, yeah, it's exactly. It's not the.
Yep.
You can make a case that Full Moon Fever is, you know, it's not, but you can say, oh, it's kind of ELO-ish, or it's got that kind of feel to it, and that, you know, that thing. And I think that Highway Companion is kind of like the mashup, of Full Moon Fever and Wildflowers. It's got the vulnerable stuff. It's got the great tight production, but scaled back and kind of brought down a little bit, and not so architectural the way he does it, but like, you know. Like songs like Saving Grace and just, you know, like there's a lot on there. And I, if you're not into Tom Petty and the Heartbreakers, I would say check out his three solo albums. Like, I think it's an interesting part of his career that you can kind of pull out of everything that he's done. You know, the Wilburys were one thing. It's kind of like, okay, they're a group, and it's kind of, you know, it could be like hillbilly-ish or kind of a little bit goofy. Pull out the three solo albums, I would say. What do you think? And just
no, I totally agree.
Check those out, and I think you'll get a good feel.
Well, that's how it came. Yeah, that's how it was for us, wasn't it? I mean, I got into Tom Petty. It was very much these albums, and like I said, the work that came after Wildflowers to me still isn't your typical Heartbreakers type of stuff. He's doing blues. He's doing. Mm-hmm. They're going like real deep and, you know, more rootsy. The quality of the songwriting is that much stronger. I prefer this period in Tom Petty's career rather than going back to
the jangly guitars.
The jangly guitar. I mean, there's nothing wrong with it. Don't get me wrong. Right. There's really nothing wrong with that stuff. I you know, I love it for what it is, but you know, for him to emerge as he did during this period, it was a great thing to see.
Yeah, it just shows longevity. And he's just, you know, he wasn't gonna certainly go quietly into that night, especially with like the last DJ and stuff like that. Still had a lot of anger, still had a lot of things to say, and a lot of opinions. So yeah, absolutely. I would say grab the three solo albums. I think you'll get a nice cross section of the development. And that's what, 89 to 2006. So that's like a 17-year span.
Mm-hmm.
But I think you get two that are almost on top of each other, and then you got a 12-year kind of pause, and then he revisits his solo work again, which I think was kind of interesting that there wasn't another one dropped in like the late 90s or early 2000s.
That's right. So I do recall, I think I might embarrass you a little bit.
Oh boy. Again? Jeez. I don't like this seat at all. The seat's getting hot.
I do recall the day, unfortunately, that we lost Tom Petty. And I remember, you know, getting a text from you. You know, did you hear about Tom? I was like, yeah, you know, it sucks, you know. And I think I called you not to, you know, just like,
yeah, I don't know if I called you or you called me right after.
And you couldn't talk. You were so emotionally distraught over it. I had never seen you get this emotional about anybody. Yeah, yeah. Frankly, especially somebody. I mean, what was going through your head there? What really? I always wanted to know. Like, I never really asked you. Yeah. But what did it? Like, what was it about Tom Petty's death that really got to you at that point?
I don't know what. Yeah, it was kind of strange. It was because I remember that when I called you too, and I was kind of like, yeah, oh my god, I couldn't believe this. It was just like maybe because it was so unexpected, so sudden, and just like he was one of the good guys.
Yeah,
like he was a guy that you like. Tom Petty's a guy that you rooted for. He seemed like a guy that was approachable.
Yeah.
Like this is a guy that you could be talking to in a diner somewhere and not know it's him. And like, so like he was one of the good ones, you know, what, you know, and we wouldn't find out until around that time or a little bit before all the struggles he had. He had a significant amount of struggles with heroin and drugs and not even counting what he was going through before he passed away with his hip and all that stuff. But, so I think it was such a shock, you know, and just kind of, you know, he was one of the guys, right? And for me, like it was like another Wilbury, you know, it was kind of like, you know, George Harrison and Roy Orbison. So like a lot of these artists that I really like, it's like, no, not another one, you know, and then Glenn Frey. And it's like, you know, like, no, not another one.
That was very much, I was going to say Glenn Frey.
Yeah.
He took that one. That one took me by surprise.
Yeah.
It's very much the same thing. Yeah.
You know, unfortunately, I guess we were fortunate enough to experience these artists in their heyday. And I think that's what it is too. And maybe it's kind of a feeling of your own mortality, not to get too deep in it.
That's right.
But it's kind of like, yeah, if you're, you know, we're losing these idols or these artists that we really connect with and have been a part of our lives. It's, you know, right. I mean, it is a part of our lives. When you listen to, if you're a music lover and you listen to it as much as we do,
a little piece of you dies.
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah. You know, it's like, oh, God,
it's
damn,
hard.
You know, it's like,
it really is hard.
Yeah. And that one, for some reason, I was just like really hit. And I think I called you afterwards. I was like, I got to talk to Eric. I just got to like talk to somebody about it.
Yeah. And you couldn't talk. I got to hang up. Like, I'm like, wow, I've never heard
speechless?
You choke up. No, I think I might have seen you tear up once in my life.
Charlotte's Web. Know,
it was Guardians 2.
Guardians 2, yes.
Both were sitting there freaking sobbing.
Oddly, we're both crying when Yondu was like, I'm Mary Poppins, yo.
No, but I recall a few other times.
Absolutely. You know, I do have tear ducts, contrary to popular belief. They're very small.
But that really got me, and I was just kind of like, but it, you know, you kind of approach it from the standpoint of trying to be realistic about it. Well, you know, the music lives on. We didn't know these people personally, you know, you kind of go there, but on the other hand, you do know them through the music. So it is a blow.
When you internalize that, when you said this album was important to me for X, Y, and Z, it is a part of you then, right?
You're absolutely right.
Yep. It's hit you in a place that maybe other songs hit other people. And that's the whole thing. And that's the beauty of music and film and art is you don't know how you're going to connect with it and you don't know what effect it'll have on you. And sometimes until it's gone, right? Until that, you know, then you realize, oh man, wow. Mm-hmm. You know, never again. And it's, you know, so yeah, that's what it was without, you know, putting too fine a point on it.
Well, that being
now that everyone's all depressed and like, you know,
going out on a, but you know, so, yeah, we miss him. He's, you know, he was truly one of the great ones. And, I mean, such a fine gentleman. I think you just seemed like a genuinely great person, great soul. And, you know, he is missed. So,
yeah. But before we close, just one other tidbit about him in that Full Moon Fever era right before it, somebody tried to kill him.
That's right. Somebody tried to burn his house down.
He got like noticed that his house was on fire or something and it was burning down. And when they did the investigation, it wasn't an accident. It was arson. And that was kind of a wake up call for him. He's like, someone like tried to kill me. Like, this wasn't like a burner left on or a candle that tipped over. Right. It was like someone like lit
someone
my house
tried
on
to
fire.
Assassinate me. Yeah.
And that's where that song, I Won't Back Down, actually came from, was like a statement of, I'm not, you know, I'm here. You're not going to frighten me. So, so good on him for, you know,
absolutely
for standing up to it. So,
all right. So that's Wildflowers. Check it out, folks. If you haven't heard it, I would highly recommend you get the vinyl. You don't even have to get the full on deluxe package of this thing with the multiple, you know, there's like five different discs and all this kind of stuff, you know, just get the album, the album and all the rest. And there's another vinyl that he released, and it's just alternate, the best of the alternate versions, with some extra bonus tracks on there. So though these two, I highly recommend. And that's going to do it for this episode of the 3324 podcast. I am Eric. You know, check us out, like I said before and early on, and check us out on Facebook, Instagram, and YouTube. We'll be looking forward to you. We do bi-weekly live shows, so we'll be looking for you there. And so for Dean, I am Eric, and we'll catch you on the flip side.
You've been listening to the 3324 podcast with Dean Legiro and Eric Cooper. You can find us on your favorite podcast provider. So please like, subscribe, and rate to become a part of the 3324 family. Your feedback is important, so make sure to follow us on Instagram and Facebook at 3324 Podcast and on Twitter at 3324P to join the conversation.